Okay, today's daf. We are starting at the bottom of Yutet Amabet. Tanu Rabbanan. It's about nine lines from the bottom. The very end of the line is Tafresh. That's Tanu Rabbanan. Okay. We're in the middle of, again, this concept of Hapesha Asar Hu Hapesha Yitir, right? If we only know based on those witnesses that they come forward and they say, this case in the Mishnah was, there's a shtar. We're going to get into all sorts of issues relating to validating signatures on a document. What the status of signatures on a document? Is that the same as if two witnesses came into court and testified? Okay, how do we relate to these two signatures that are on the document? Is it valid testimony? It seems we have to validate them in some way, and then once they're validated, then what's their status? There's all different discussions about it. We get into a lot of really interesting discussions today about how our memory works, about how validating signatures work. There's a lot of interesting things here. Anyway, and also we're going to see contradictory testimony. Okay, maybe we'll even start, before we start here, about two major concepts that are important to know. When it comes to witnesses testifying, if there's false witnesses, it's always a big question, right? You know, all those riddles. Someone's lying, you don't know who's lying, right? So how do you figure out who's the one who's lying? So when you have, you know, one group of witnesses come here and one group of witnesses say something different, right? How do you know? Great stick figures. Okay. These guys say one thing and these guys say something else. What do? They contradict each other. That's called Edut Hakhasha. Edut Hakhasha, what basically happens is we throw them out of court and we don't believe anybody. Okay? That's Edut Hakhasha. But if the first two witnesses come and say, we saw something happen on a certain day, and then two witnesses come and they say, Imanu Hayitem, we were with you on that day, they're not saying anything about the testimony itself. They're just testifying about the witnesses, just like these guys would be credible to come and say, I know you're the father of the Baldin and you're a Karov and you can't testify. Or they could come and say, I know you're a robber, and they could come and testify against the witnesses. Likewise, they could come and testify against the witnesses and say, we know that you were with us somewhere else and you couldn't possibly have seen what happened. And therefore, we call them, okay, these are then called the Mizimim. They turn the others into Edim Zomimim. Okay, this is the famous thing called Edim Zomimim. That's a case where we say, whatever the Edim tried to testify against the other person, they then get punished for. Okay, so if they tried to say, so-and-so killed someone else, then they get killed. Okay, when we get to Masechet Makot, we're going to learn all the details of Edim Zomimim. But for now, that's the basics. Okay, so Edim Zomimim get punished. Edei HaKhasha do not get punished because we don't know who to believe. Now, while it's true that it's possible that the Mizimim are lying also, okay? But some of the Mefarshim explain it as it's a Chiddush, like the Torah was Mechadesh, but basically this is the way it's going to be. And therefore we believe it just because the Torah said so. Some people say, no, it's really just logical because they're, just like we would accept their testimony against the witnesses themselves to say they're Psulei Edut or they're Krovim or something, we can accept their testimony that they weren't there at the time. So there's two different ways to understand it. That's Hakhasha and Hazama. Okay? So now, we're going to learn a case here. Tana Rabbanan. Shtayim Chatumim. So again, we're at Yutet Amabet, about 8-9 lines from the bottom. Shnayim chatumim al hashtar umetu. Okay, so now we have dead witnesses, okay? When we talked about a valid document with witnesses, it's like there's witnesses, but now they're dead. Ubau shnayim min hashuk. Okay, that means two guys off the street. Vamru, yadanu shektav yadamu, aval anusimayu, ktanimayu, psulei durayu. Okay, this is like yesterday's, but yesterday's document was where the Edim themselves said, we were forced to sign, or we were ktanim when we signed, or we were psulei edut, okay? But in this case, it's two other people validate the signatures, and then they say, so now again, it's hapesha sarhu hapesha yitir, because it's not the guy himself, right, the witnesses themselves, but it's two other people are the only ones who we have to validate the signatures. The Edim were no longer there for us to ask them anything, so they're dead. And those people who validated also said, though, but they're no good. Hare elu ne'emanim. So now these guys are believed. But im yesh edim shektav yad, again, they're believed because hapesh asar hu hapesh yitir. We're validating this testimony only on the basis of them. Okay, so therefore, they're allowed to then say, oh yeah, but it was a bad situation, and because without them, we'd have nothing. So basically, once they come, hapesh asar hu hapesh yitir. But im yesh edim shektav yadam huzeh, if we have other witnesses that say that these are valid signatures, o shehaya ktav yadam yotzei mimakom acher, mishtar shekara alav irer v'huchzak bebetin, or we don't have witnesses, but what do we have? We have proof, like on file in the courts, that, now here's an interesting line which we're going to deal with later, from a case where there was a shtar that someone tried to say, oh, I don't believe that there's, you know, I think there's some problem here. They checked into it. They found that the signatures were actually valid, and therefore, hukzak bebeidin, that these are good signatures. We're going to ask later, why does it have to be like that? Why can't you just say we have the signatures on file? Why does it have to be that it comes from a case where shtar shekara alav irer? Okay, we'll get to that later in the Gemara. Ein elu ne'emanim. So now we don't have hapesh asar in this case. Remember, because it's not hapesh asar, right? It's we have some proof from somewhere else. So therefore, we don't have hapesh asar anymore. And therefore, we're going to say it's a problem. Okay, we don't believe them. Umagvina be kibishtara ma'alya. And therefore, we can assume that what? That these signatures are good signatures. This document's a good document. And we're going to basically say whatever... you know, whatever it said in the shtar, we're going to, if it was a halva'ah, right, someone loaned money, so you have to pay back the money. And we're not going to believe them. Remember, okay, let's just go back to our case. Two guys, okay, let's put it like here. These guys are now dead, okay? They're signed on the shtar, okay? And these guys come and say, okay, it's their signature, but they were forced, okay? They were forced to sign, it wasn't a real signature, etc. Since we have proof from outside the case that the witnesses have, that the signatures are good, we're going to say, we go with this document, and the document is fine. We're not going to believe these witnesses who tell us otherwise. Okay. So now, what are we going to say here? Vamai, treyu trey ninhu. Why don't we say that this is two witnesses who say it's good, two witnesses who say it's not good, and, I'm sorry, the flip, right? The two witnesses who were signed on the document are like Edud, right? And that's like two witnesses who say this is a good document. Two witnesses who come and say, no, those guys were psulim, and or they were forced, or anything, whatever they say. It should be Edud HaKasha. And what we learned in the beginning is Edud HaKasha, when two cannot contradict you, we just throw everyone out of court. We don't say that this is a good document. Okay?
The first two witnesses, are you saying, are the signatures themselves?
Yeah, the signatures themselves, plus we have the proof that they're good signatures.
And
so we have proof that it's good testimony.
The evidence is stronger or weaker than testimony.
Right, so they don't seem to think there's any difference. They're treating it as the same, so they're saying, how can you say that? So Amar of Sheshet, we're going to learn from here, Zot Omeret, Hakchashat Chilat Hazamahi. Okay, what does that mean? This is an interesting statement. This means... Now, I set it up as if there's two different cases. There's hakasha and there's hazama. But what Rav Sheshet says is that hakasha can be the beginning of hazama. In other words, sometimes before the edim or mizimim, first there's contradictory evidence, and then that can lead to a case where we have edim zomimim, where it's witnesses come and say, imanu ayitem. So what does this mean? Hakasha can be the first step toward hazama. The first is contradictory, and that can lead to hazama. And therefore, he's going to say this. Okay, because hakasha is the lead-in to hazama, therefore, what do we say? That the rules that apply for hakasha, for hazama, are also relevant to hakasha. In other words, if you say that something can be a stepping stone to something else, and the thing you're trying to get to has certain rules about it, well, then the first step has to have those same rules. Otherwise, it can never lead to it. So what would be this situation here? What are they going to learn from? Ukeshem she'em mizimin et ha'edim ela bifnehem, kach em makhishin et ha'edim ela bifnehem. What does this mean? Hazama can only happen in front of the witnesses. You can't come to court and say, we were with the witnesses. They have to be there. You said, imanu ayitem, right? It's always phrased in the Gemara, imanu, with you. We were with you, meaning they're there. You have to do it in front of their faces. So hakasha also has to happen in front of their faces. What does that mean? Now, remember, these witnesses are dead. So therefore, the witnesses who signed the document are no longer here. They're dead. So when the other two come and contradict, that's not Eidut HaKasha, according to Rav Sheshet. He says that the fact that we don't accept this and say this is Eidut HaKasha proves my point, right? We can learn from here that HaKasha is the beginning steps of Hazama, and therefore, whatever criteria apply for HaKasha must apply for Hazama, or certain criteria for Hazama apply to HaKasha. And what is that going to be? That you can only do it if they're there. And these guys are no longer there, and therefore, basically, you can't contradict their evidence. Okay, the Gemara is going to ask a question on this in a minute. But that's the assumption right now. So Amar Le Rav Nachman, he says this causes something that you would, that leads to something you would say is totally counterintuitive. Ilu havu kaman. So if they were here, if they were alive, what would happen? Umakhishin lehu, have hakasha. V'lo ayu mashkichinam behu, tahave leidu, mukheshet, right? You're trying to say that if these guys were alive who signed the document and come to witnesses and say, yes, they signed the document, but they were anusim, okay, they were forced. In that case, what are you going to say? It's a Eidut HaKasha and we don't validate the document, but hashta delitnihu, but now that they're dead, to ilu hava lekaman, dilma hava modulahu, mehemne, in other words, but now that they're not here, okay, because if they were here, in other words, maybe they would have agreed with them. And there, one second. And therefore, right, it would be, one second. It would be stronger to say, one second. If the Edim, if they were still here, and these first guys would agree with the second guys and say, yes, we were anusim, you're going to say, though, because it was Eidut HaKasha, we're going to throw it out of court, and yet now, when they're actually, not, when they're not even here at all, now we're going to believe them more? In other words, it doesn't make any sense that these guys should have more strength, more power in death than in life. Okay? So basically, he's saying, it doesn't make any sense what you're saying. How could you possibly say that we're going to give more strength to them when they're dead than when they're alive? So what does he answer? Ella Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says it must be for a different reason. Okay, tre lahade tre, v'okay mamon v'ches kamare, midi dehava anichse bar shake. Okay, we'll see this in a minute. So what does he mean? He says it's not that we can't have a dud ha'chasha shalo b'fnehem. It's because we have two against two, and we're basically going to leave the money in the hands of whoever it was in the hands of. Okay? That's what he's basically saying. That, right, when you have a suffix, that's what you do. So basically, in a shtar halva'a, what are we going to say? Who's got the money? The lova has the money, right? So we're going to leave the money in the lova's hands. Right? What did we say where, which according to him, one second, he explains, right there, not so. What he's saying in the end is, what is the bright to say? Because it actually comes out the opposite. But listen, it says here, "Hare elu ne'amanim," right? But in the second case, "Ein elu ne'amanim." So what does it mean, "Ein elu ne'amanim"? These guys aren't believed. So what does that mean? It means that they're not believed to say the shtar is no good, but they are. They do have something. In other words, they've already created some sort of a question mark on this case. So now that we have a question mark, and as according to Rav Sheshet's understanding, what happens if someone loaned money from you, you have the shtar in your hand, you can demand the money, right? Because the shtar is good because of the signed signatures. But comes Rav Nachman, he says no. When they say they're not believed, it means they're not believed to eliminate the shtar and say the shtar is no good. But we now have a question mark on the shtar. When we have a question mark, what do we say? Put two up against two. And since we don't know what to do, we leave the money in whoever's hands it is. So therefore, it's going to come to the opposite conclusion, that if it's a loan, he's basically not going to be able to demand the loan back. Okay? So they both understand the braita, right? It obviously depends on the situation with Rav Nachman, because it's going to depend on what kind of a shtar it was and who's got the money. But usually with a shtar, someone's demanding money from somebody else, right, if that's the case. So if it's someone demanding money from someone else, he can't, basically, because we have this concept, again, we've said this a number of times, someone who's trying to take money from someone, the burden of proof lies on him. Okay?
Yeah. Property.
What?
And if it's property.
Right, if it's property, then the money stays in the property of the whoever has the shtar. Exactly, the property stays there. So then the shtar would be valid. That's why I say it depends on the situation.
So then it really pays to either wait till the witnesses die or you kill them. No, you do much better if the witnesses are dead.
It's true. You could kill the witnesses, but generally we don't suspect people that they're going to go that far as to kill the witnesses. We'll see a case where they say we don't expect people to go that far, although it's a little bit different than that. But right, it's true. It is better off. But again, he might
wait a long time.
Look, if you want to prove that this property is yours, so it would pay to wait till they're dead. But if you're the other guy, so you might come earlier. Right, you would come earlier, right, or pick young witnesses, right. That's another thing, right. There's all these cases, you know, these. Stuff gets involved with these cases in the Rabbanut where they're trying to prove about some guy who got married, you know, was the parents or the grandparents, you know, was it a good marriage and things like that. And, you know, who knows who these rabbis were? They're long dead, and you have to do research into them, who they were. And, you know, it's complicated once people die to figure out what the validity, you know, especially, you know, in America in the 50s, like, there was all this, there was like this conservadox, and, you know, how orthodox was it? And there's all sorts of, you know, there were these orthodox shuls with mixed seating and, you know, so, you know, and then it's actually interesting because the Rabbanut says, oh, an Orthodox shul with mixed seating, that must be pasul. You know, where in those days, that was a little bit more of the norm in certain communities, and there actually were Orthodox rabbis, and
that
complicated.
Like,
so you see how when time passes, and we're going to get into a whole bunch of things here about time passing and people's memories, and anyway, okay. So, yeah, they said at the end here, midi dehava nechse de bar shakya, just like the money of Bar Shakya. Now, what's Bar Shakya? Bar Shakya isn't his name. Bar Shakya means, Bar doesn't necessarily always mean son. It means like a trait. So he was known as a shote. Okay? He was a little bit not all there, but sometimes he was there and sometimes he wasn't there. Okay? Sometimes he was sane, sometimes he was not sane. So, what's the case here? Bar Shakya zavin nichse. Okay? He bought nechassim?
Sold.
He sold. Okay, sorry. He sold nechassim. Okay. Va'atu beitre va'amre kashu shote zavin. Okay, he wasn't sane when he sold it, in which case it wouldn't be a good sale, right? Va'atu beitre va'amre kashu chalim zavin. No, when he was sane, he sold it, in which case it would be a good sale. Amrav ashi. Okay, tre lahade tre, right? We have contradictory evidence. But okay, mamana b'cheska bar shakya. In other words, the property is in his hands now. So even though it says he had a shtar that said he sold it, right? Someone's trying to prove, hey, this is mine. Here's my shtar. But since we can't prove either which way, we're going to leave the money in his hands because we're basically throwing all the witnesses out, and we're going to keep it exactly where it was. But now they just have a little caveat. V'lo amaran ela de'id lechazaka de'avhatei. This is only if we're talking, let's say it was his house, and his house was the property of his family's, which means it really is his house. But if it wasn't proven that it was his father's property, amrinan kshusho tezavan ukshusho tezavin. In other words, you could say he never actually had a good sale on it when he bought it. Maybe he wasn't sane when he bought the property, in which case he has no chazaka on the land. So it has to be that we know he had a good chazaka on the land, in which case then we can say we're going to keep the money in his property because it's in his property. But in order to say that concept, you have to really have it clear that it was in his property because this guy can't have a kinyan on anything if he's not sane.
The fact that we were talking about with the katan, remember when they wanted to take the property and what chazaka was 3 years.
Right, and then, right, 3 years. The chazaka has to be a gadol in order to have the chazaka of 3 years. Exactly. It's the same. It's all based on the same concept. Okay. Amar Rabbi Avahu. Now, if you recall, what did Rav Sheshet say? Rav Sheshet said, you can learn from here that hachash is the beginning of hazama, right? It's the stepping stone toward hazama. And therefore, since you can't be mezim the edim, elabifnehem, you also can't be makhish the edim, elabifnehem, meaning that in our case, you can't be mechish these edim who were signed because they're not alive. Rabbi Abahu now disagrees with him. Eim is inimina ta'edim ela bifnehem. With Hazama, that is the case. You can only do it in front of them. Umakhishina ta'edim shelo bifnehem. Okay, but you can contradict witnesses even if they're not there. So this could be a good case of hakasha. The Hazama shelo bifnehem, nihida Hazama lohave hakasha miahavya. Okay, so now he says something interesting. If they're mezim shelo bifnehem, okay, so two witnesses come and say, Manu Ayitem, right? But they weren't there anymore, right? They're not there. But what do they say? It might not be hazama, meaning you can't get the onesh of kasher zamam, but it's still considered hakasha. In other words, if two witnesses come and say manu ayitem, and we don't have the right criteria to say this is a dut hazama, right? Therefore, the agent. What's really important to understand here? The main difference between hakasha and hazama is punishment. If you have a dut hakasha, we don't know who to believe, so we throw everybody out of court. Nobody gets punished. But if you become a zomem, then we punish you. You get kasher zamam. Whatever you tried to do the other guy, you get punished. So in a case where you do hazama, you try to say manu ayitem to these two guys and they're not there, so you can't do hazama, but you can't. It's enough to contradict and basically say we're going to throw everybody out of court. Okay? It's not enough to punish. Okay, we're done with that issue now. Amar mar. Now we're going to get into something else we said. Now we're going to get back to this kara lav ir er. Okay, saying that this document is valid based on, right, finding proof of their signatures from somewhere else. If you recall in the Braita, it said like this. Im yesh edim, now I'm reading from the Gemara we're up to. Im yesh edim shektav yadam huzeh. O shayak tav yadam yotzei mimakom acher, mishtar shakara alav ir er. Okay, from, how do we know, right? We have proof from another place. By the way, in the earlier sugya, before in our Mishnah, I think it is, it said, if ktav yadam yotzei mimakom acher, period. Right? If we can prove somehow that we have on record their signatures. But here it adds these words, from what? How do we know? How can we validate their signatures? From a shtar that someone, kara alav ir er, someone was me'ar er alav, said, oh, I think there's a problem with the shtar. Vihukzach bebeitin. And then the beitin said, no, we validate these signatures. Ein ne'emanim. Then they're not believed, because again, it's not a pesh asar, because someone else already showed that the document exists. So now they say, kara lav yirer in, lo kara lav yirer lo, right? You can assume from here that only if it was a document that was validated from, you know, an issue. There was an issue, and then they came and validated it. Misayale the Rabbi Asi. This supports what Rav Asi said. Amar Rav Asi, ein mekaymin et hashtar, ela mishtar shekara lav yirer v'uchzak bebeitin. He says that's the only way to validate signatures. If you just have signatures on file, that's not enough. It has to be, now the reason seems to be because what? It has to be that there was a case where someone made, you know, big siman sheila, like there's some problem here. They looked into it. Now obviously, right, if you just want to validate signatures, right, in banks they do it all the time, right? Some places are careful about validating signatures, some places aren't so careful, right? But when you have an issue that comes up and they ask the court, we don't think these are their signatures, and they look and they research, they're obviously going to research it much more than just generally having signatures on file. And therefore, only if they've done their research, which we can only assume happened in a case where there was kara alav ir er. Okay, so that's the position of Rav Asi. Not everybody agrees with this, but that's his position, and you can say that he finds support for his position in this braita. Okay?
Research would mean that they found more eduyot, I guess.
Right, well, then you could say there's edu, right? But maybe they don't have it on record anymore that they had. And how many records do they keep? Do they keep records that two witnesses came and said these signatures are valid? No, but the assumption is that they must have looked into it and figured out a way. Okay? Okay. Amri Nahardea. Eim mekaymin et hashtar. Now, in Nahardea, they say like this. Okay, or a case of ketuba, right? Ketuba has signatures at the bottom. Either you find two ketubot of the guy's signature, or mishtei sadot, or two shtarot, right, that people signed on that someone sold a field. Okay, so that means that only if it's two sadot, it's in a case where it's two sadot, we have a shtar about the sadeh, okay, or two shtarot about it, about different fields. And the owners of those fields have been living there for 3 years and nobody's made any claim. Okay, Beshufi means in peace, you know, that nobody was claiming anything against them. So now this is very strange. What does this mean? Does this mean two ketubot that were validated in the court? Or does this mean if we don't have validation, we can, right, what seems to be the general approach here is if we don't have any proof, okay, but we have two other documents that these guys are signed on, that's enough to say this is valid. So now, what Sharon, you were asking, this seems to say that there's an alternate way. It doesn't just have to be that the Adim came and brought proof. We can have two other documents that show, oh, look, he signed here and he signed there, and look, the signatures all match up, right? You know this from the bank. When you open a bank account, you sign, right? And then the bank is going to use that as your base signature. So when they check your signature on documents, they're going to check based on that. So here, it's not the bank doing it, right? It's just saying, oh, he signed here like that, he signed there like that. What's really interesting is the Yerushalmi brings up a possibility of what about letters this guy wrote? Can you do like a handwriting check, right? This is his handwriting, right? This is how he signed at the bottom of the letter or something. So the Ritva and the Meiri say that you can't use letters as proof because letters, he's not signing for the sake of signing, right? When you sign at the bank, when they ask you to sign, you're going to be careful about what your signature is going to look like because you're going to know that in the end they're going to check it. And when you sign on a document, it's the same thing. You're going to know that they might check your signature at some point, especially you know now that we learned all this, we know that they were checking signatures. But when you're just writing a letter, you write anyway, you can't prove handwriting from that. So it's an interesting, right, you think about all those handwriting people who analyze handwriting and all sorts of, and there are people who can recognize handwriting, they're very talented at, but what they're saying here is it can only be from documents that are official documents that you were signing in a particular way. So it's an interesting, the fact that they're having a discussion about this, you know, and how they understand it is very interesting.
Well, it's good though, because it's all legal documents. So
right.
You want to make sure that...
Exactly. It's a legal system, and they want to make sure that no one's forging. We're going to see some other things about forgeries here as we go on. So right now. Amar Shimi Barashi, ubiyotze mitachat yad acher, aval miyad atzmo lo. That's if we find these documents that he signed, okay, with his name in other people's hands. But if they were in his hands, we don't. Why? Okay, so what's the assumption here? That if he has these documents in his house with his signature, right, even though it's not like a good signature, maybe, right, so the question is, what's he, oh no, sorry. Miyad atzmo doesn't mean him, sorry, it means the, I knew something was wrong, it means the guy who's claiming, right, not the guy signed on the chart, the guy, right, the baldin, okay, the plaintiff. So he's claiming, right, here's his signature. And look, I have two documents in my house that he also signed. Okay, well, right, the signature is dead. So when it, right, so if he brings out two documents from his house, well, maybe he forged the signature, right? So now they're going to say, but I don't understand. Right? In other words, what are you concerned? You're concerned he's forging signatures. So Dilma Azal, Vachaza, Vaad Mazayef. Right? In other words, maybe he went to the guy's house, saw the guy had his tuba hanging on the wall, saw the signature, right? Went into his other friend's house, saw the signature there. He said, oh, I'll write a signature just like this. So what do they say? Kulehai lo matze mechaven. In other words, so now there's two different possibilities. Either he's not going to go that far, okay, like Shari said in the beginning, right? You're not going to go that far as to kill people just to make sure they're dead so that you, right? In other words, you're not going to go that far as to go into people's houses, find documents and do that. Or really the reverse, maybe he would. But without the document in hand, what, he's going to memorize it in his head exactly how the signature was written and go home and do it at home, right? It's not so easy to do that. When they're in the privacy of your own home, it's very simple. But I wonder if they had tracing paper. You know? okay. So, now, Tan Rabbanan. Kotev Adam Eduto L'Shtar Me'id Alav Afilu L'Achar Kama Shani. Now there's a whole different thing we're going to get into. What does it mean to testify about something? What does it mean you remember something? This is like an age-old question, right? Are your memories based on pictures that you've seen that remind you of the event, or are they real, or stories that they tell in your family, right? How do you remember things from when you were a kid? Do you actually remember them happening? So how does testimony work? Do you have to actually remember it happening? What if, right, nowadays people do this all the time, I'm sure in those days too, but in order to remember something, what do? You go to a meeting, you take notes, right? That's how you remember things. So what if the witness saw something and then he wrote down notes to himself to remind him of what happened? So then when he remembers and he testifies, is he testifying based on his notes or is he testifying based on his memory? Because testifying based on something written is not valid in court. Now, you can't come to court and say, well, I wrote here that this is what happened, so this must be what happened.
I don't remember anything, but...
Right. So now we're going to get into a very interesting discussion as to where do we draw the line and what's allowed and what's not allowed. So... Let's read again. The Brita says, Kotev Adam Eduto al Ashtar, he can write down his testimony on a document, Umeid alav afilu lachar kama shanim, and he can therefore come with that testimony and say what it says in the document, basically, even after many years, or some years. Am Rav Huna, v'husha zochram atzmo. Rav Huna says that bright is only true if he also has memory of, you know, he remembers it, and it's not just that it's he's reading us from his document. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, afa pisha ein zochram atzmo. Even if he doesn't remember it himself, it's still okay because the assumption is he was called to be a witness in this, whatever it was. He wrote down his notes, and so, yeah, he doesn't remember, but he has his notes to prove it. Amar Rabba, shma mina mid Rabbi Yochanan, so you can infer from what Rabbi Yochanan just said, that even if he doesn't remember it, hani betre de yade sahaduta, let's say two witnesses went to testify for something, umenashe chad minayhu, if one of them forgets, right, years later they come and say, do you remember there was this loan that took place, blah, 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 and one of them forgets, so the other one can remitkar, can Dalet and Zion switch. So it's Zachar, right, Mazkir. He can remind his friend what happened, okay? So now, he says, that can be inferred from Rabbi Yochanan, that one witness can remind the other one, and the other one can testify and say, oh, yeah, I was with him, and he remembers, and that's okay. Which is interesting, right? Ibayelahu. So now they ask, Atzmomai, what if the Baldin reminds him, right? Let's say I take out a loan or I lend money to someone, okay? And I invite two of you to be my witnesses. And then 10 years later, I go to collect, right? And I need you to support me that because I didn't do it with a shtar. I just did it in front of witnesses. And you guys don't remember. And I say, don't you remember on this and this day? And you don't really remember, but I remind you of the details and you go then and testify. Now that seems a little fishy because I could be, right, if you don't remember and I'm the one reminding you, I'm obviously nogev davar. So, what do they say? Rav Chaviva Amar Afilu Atzmo. Okay? Mar Barid Ravina Amar Atzmo Lo. Okay? So Rav Chaviva said, if you remind him, it's okay. But Mar Barid Rav Ashi says, no, it doesn't work. V'hilchata, the Gemara says, Atzmo Lo. Okay? We don't allow a person to remind someone else about his testimony. But, again, there's going to be a caveat. Eat Surva Merabananhu Afilu Atzmo. Okay? And they're going to bring a story to support it. If he was a Talmid Chacham, then we even allow the Baal Din to remind him. Okay? And we're going to see a story that supports this.
If the Talmid Chacham
is the Baal Din. Because the assumption is the Talmid Chacham is not going to lie and make up a story, right? This is a whole interesting thing about getting into the hierarchy in the Gemara between, the Talmidei Chachamim and maybe those who weren't, and, the ins and the outs and the...
But it makes sense. If you think about it, you go to court and they say you're leading the witness. if he's your witness and the litigant or the
yeah, you're allowed to... Yeah.
And you're leading a witness, you're not allowed
You're not allowed to lead the witness. Right.
It makes sense that the litigant can't say, but wait, don't you remember that you saw me do something?
Exactly. However, what's interesting here is that the Gemara is saying if he's a Talmid Chacham, then we allow it. Now, this is a little tricky nowadays, especially, right? You can see that there's a lot of Talmidei Chachamim that might be Talmidei Chachamim, and yet, when it comes to other issues, they're not necessarily the most trustworthy. But in the Gemara, there's a very clear, there's groups. Like, for example, I'll give you another example. They sometimes call him a Chaver. It's the same type of thing. They say that hatra'ah, you need to have a warning for, it could be that a Talmid Chacham, this actually goes to against a Talmid Chacham, that he wouldn't need warning before being, in order to get punished, you need to have the two people say, do you know that if you do this, you'll get punished with this punishment? And without that, you can't punish. But some people say, no, Chaver doesn't need hatra'ah, because he's in a different, he's supposed to know, right? Here's the same assumption, he's supposed to know. So, he's supposed to be honest, and he's supposed to be good, and he's supposed to know his stuff, and, obviously we know that this isn't always the case, but again, the question is, who is a Torah Merabana? Like, who determines that? That also might be complicated. What makes someone a Torah Merabana? The fact that he just sits in yeshiva and learns, or, but again, like I said, nowadays you just have all sorts of people who really are Talmidei Chachamim that end up with, problems in other departments. Okay, so now, here's our story. He knew some testimony about Rav Kahana, and Rav Kahana needed him to testify. Amarle, so Rav Kahana says to Rav Ashi, "Mi dechir mar?" Again, that same root, dechar, zachar. Do you remember? Hai sahaduta, this evidence, right? You were my witness. Amarle, lo. He says, "Sorry, I don't remember." So then he says to him, "V'lav hachi v'hachi hava." Don't you remember? It was this and this. And this is what happened. Amarle, lo yadana. I'm sorry, I just don't know. Lisof idkar, Rav Ashi. Okay, so in the end, he did remember. Now, this has happened to you, this happens to me all the time. I forget something, I'm in the moment, I meet someone, and they say, oh, don't you remember me? And I'm, you know, sort of whatever. And then I go home later, and eventually it comes back to me. Okay, so Rav Ashi eventually remembered. So Asidle, so he goes to court, he doesn't even tell Rav Kahana, he just goes to court and testifies. So Chazi l'Rav Kahana, maybe he goes to court where Rav Kahana wasn't, right, and he says the testimony. So Chazi l'Rav Kahana, dehava machasen. He sees Rav Kahana, who's like feeling very uncomfortable, and he's hesitating, and he doesn't know what to do, because he feels like, is he doing this just because I reminded him, you know, and he doesn't really know his testimony? So Amar Le, Rav Ashi says to him, Misfarat alaka samichna? What, you think I'm relying on you? Ana hu derama yanav sheva adkere. It was me who jogged my memory, and I eventually remembered. Okay, so have no worries. Okay, so that's that. Now we're going to move into an issue about... I'm just trying to remember how this connects, because it's a little off the topic, but it connects because it's talking about, one second.
Memory.
About memory. Right. It gets into memory about how far back we can remember things, okay? But it's a totally off topic. Okay, we're getting into now, it's a Mishnah in Ohalot, I believe. Yeah, in Ohalot. Tanan Hatam, it says in the Mishnah here, okay? And it has to do with Tuma and Tara, and the whole thing is going to be, is it possible we see this big mound of dirt? Is it possible that people were buried there, that there's dead bodies or dead body parts that would be metame? Now, if you recall, we talked about a suffik in Rashuta Rabim. What did we learn just last week? Sveiko tahor. If you have a suffik in Rashuta Rabim, it should be tahor. So this case, you have a mound of dirt, suffik tumah, because maybe something's buried in there, should be tahor. But now we're going to see that depending on the situation, it's going to become tameh. Hatluliot, the tluliot is like a tail, like a, right, you know, a tail, what do you call it, a mound, a hill, right? So here we're talking about little mounds of dirt, okay? Tluliot, right, tlulia, but it means small. So, tluliot hakrovot, bein la'ir, bein la'derech, okay? If they're close either to a city or to a path, we're going to explain after what does this mean. Echad chadashot ve'echad yishana, whether they're new or whether they're old, tmeot, they're considered tamei, okay? Again, it's like what I would have said. Harichokot, if they're far from the city or far from a path, chadashot tahorot, if they're new, they're tahor, yishanot tmeot, old ones are tamei. So now we're going to explain. Ezehi krova, what does it mean to be close to? So the answer, chamishim ama. Ve'ezehi yishana, and what is old? Shishim shana, divrei Rabbi Meir. Okay? The assumption is old means 60 years old already, like people don't remember. That's the assumption here. This goes to the memory issue. After 60 years, people don't remember so much. Now, it's things that happened 60 years ago. It doesn't mean an age thing for all those who are concerned about their memory going. Okay? It doesn't mean 60 years old. It means something that happened 60 years ago. Divrei Rabbi Meir, which I assume is like the average lifespan of a person in those days. I mean, there's some place where they talk about 70, but okay. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Krova. So he has a different explanation. Krova is not 50 amma, and Rechok, I'm sorry, what's the word? Yeshana is not 60 years, but it's Krova she'en Krova himena. It's the closest to the city or closest to the path, okay? And Yeshana she'en Adam Zochra. It has to do with whether people remember or don't remember. It doesn't have to do with, we can't, you know, it's not like a number of years. It's very subjective, all this stuff. Okay, now let's understand better what's going on here. My ear umay derech. Ile my ear mamash and derech derech mamash. If we're talking about, right, the city means an actual city. And the path means an actual path. Misveika mi machzikin and tumo. We already learned. We're not machzik things to be tameh, right? Safek reshut arabim, sveiko tahor. Marish Lakish, and here they're going to explain that Ilam Tzao Utiyahu Eretz Israel. The assumption, by the way, is that they're talking about in Israel. First of all, the Mishnayot were mostly written in Israel, so it makes sense. They found an excuse, basically, and they were Matar all of Eretz Israel. It's exactly the opposite of, they say, Eretz Amim, right? Any Chutz Laaretz, the assumption is it's Tameh. But in Eretz Israel, they assumed everything is Tahor. So Amar Rabbi Zera, so therefore it can't be Samuch Le'ir or Samuch Le'derech, because we already said that's all Tahor. So Amar Rabbi Zera, Ir Hasmucha LeBeit HaKvarot. It's a city that's right next to the Beit HaKvarot. And Derech Beit HaKvarot. It's a path leading to the cemetery. So now, okay, how does that help us? Bishlama derech beit hakvarot dezimni. Okay, the assumption here is, by the way, it's, we're going to have to explain this, because if it's close to the cemetery, so why should there be something tamei there? Everyone's going to the cemetery to bury their dead. They're not going to bury them on the way to the cemetery, so it doesn't make any sense. So bishlama derech beit hakvarot dezimni dimitrame ben hashmashot umak mikaro kivro batel. Okay, what happens? It's getting to Ben Hashmasha Friday afternoon. You're running out of time, so you just bury the guy as close to the cemetery as you can get before Shabbat. And therefore, we can see a case where it's on the path to the Beit HaKvarot. Maybe someone buried them there. Ela, iras mucha lebeit HaKvarot, kulu lebeit HaKvarot azle. Everybody goes to the cemetery. No one's going to bury in the city. Am Rabbi Chanina, here's a really interesting one. Mitoch shanashim kovrot sham niflehem. Okay, I have to stop here before continuing. Here's a really interesting thing. The assumption was that if a woman lost a baby, she wanted to hide it from people. And she didn't want to make... So it's a question. The person kind of explained that she wanted to hide it. But it could be also she just didn't want to make a public thing out of it, right? We all know it's interesting nowadays because, you know, Seth just fought this battle in the courts to allow... Generally, if somebody, God forbid, loses a baby, they, you know, if it's a newborn... They don't allow, the Chevra Kedisha doesn't allow the parents to come to the funeral. They bury without the parents, and the parents can't come. Right. Right. They have a different, right. They have a whole, it's a whole different thing. So he fought because a lot of parents wanted to go to the burial and wanted to know. They wouldn't even tell people where the burial is, okay, where the baby's buried. So now they fought and they won that now you can go and you can find out where it is, and the Chevra Kedishas have to comply. So it's interesting because here the women themselves were burying them. In other words, right there, here it's like, oh, you can't even know where it is. And here the women themselves were doing the burial, but it seems they didn't want people to know about it, or maybe they just didn't want anyone there, right? Just like nowadays, God forbid if that happens, even if the parents go, generally nobody else comes, right? It's a very, very sensitive thing. So anyway, here you see the sensitivity and the way the women related to it in those days. They would, or at least there was an assumption that it was possible that the women would just bury it in a very quiet way, nowhere where anybody would know, and they just put it in this mound of dirt. Also, this is a little disgusting, people who have boils, sometimes their arms will fall off. So they might want to bury their arm in this mound of dirt. Yeah, really disgusting.
There's a logistical problem there.
What? How can they bury their arm? Well, they have one arm. Okay. So anyway, the sense would be that they would do this without anyone else knowing. Okay. And therefore, if you have this mound of dirt that's on the way to the cemetery, the assumption is they would do it on the way to the cemetery, or in this case, it's actually on the way to the cemetery. It's in the city near the cemetery. They would do it. If you find this mound of dirt, it's possible this happened. Ad chamishim ama azla. So now, why the distance of chamishim ama? So the sense is, this is an interesting one also. Ad chamishim ama azla I lechude. Tvei. Davranafshe bahada. I don't know what that word is. Davranafshe, how do they write it? Davra inish bahada. Okay. So, in other words, what's the idea here? If it's 50 amas, so she's happy to go by herself. If it's more than 50 amma, she's not going to go there by herself. She's going to take someone else to go with her. It's like a little creepy to walk that far. You know, she doesn't want to go that far out of the city on her own. Okay? Yeah, I know. You got to wonder if she just gave birth, how she's walking that far also. But the point is someone else will be with her and therefore will know about it. Okay? We'll know that this mound of dirt had something here. Right. And then she'll already go with... right. And then the assumption is she'll also take someone else with her and then she'll already go to the Beit HaKvarot. Okay. Hilkach, tuma be'eretz Yisrael lo machazkinan. Okay, but what can you infer from here? That we're not generally worried, right, about regular tumah in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, if it's more than chamishim amah, we're not going to be concerned. So now, Rav Chista is going to make the connection to our case, and we'll end with this. Am Rav Chista shma mina mi Rabbi Meir hay sahadute ad shitin shni midkar tvei lo midkar. Okay, so we can infer from Rabbi Meir's shita here that he said until 60 years, people have a memory of what was going on in this tale, or right, what had happened. So we can assume it's the same thing when it comes to testimony. The testimony people will remember, okay, for 60 years. But after 60 years, meaning we're not going to accept witnesses who come to court and say, oh, yeah, I remember from 60 years ago. Okay? So now they say, Velohi, but that's not the case. Because Hatam tu de la Ramya ale. Aval hacha keiran derami ale afilu tubanami. Now we get into the fact that what we've been talking about until now, I didn't really stress this, but edim, there's two kinds of edim, okay? We'll get into this in other sugas later on. But edut is either you saw something, like you happened to have been, right, at an event where something happened. But generally, when we talk about edut, most of the edut and the stuff we're talking about here is when the malve, you know, the guy who's lending the money, called two witnesses and said, I want you to be my witnesses. Now, if you get called to task to be someone's witnesses, you're going to remember that. Now, if that's something, you know that he called you to remember, and therefore you know that it's your job for the rest of your life to remember that this happened. Okay? And therefore, things like that. Now, what's interesting about all this? It's all getting into the memory of people, right? What people remember, what they don't remember. I had a great aunt who, I remember her once telling us this vivid story of when they sold their house in 1950, you know, her family's house, and remembering all the details of it, you know, and it was amazing to me that at the age of, you know, 88, she was telling me details of something that happened in 1950 that she remembered all the details of. I was amazed. So, in other words, our memory works in certain ways. If we're expected to remember something, then we'll remember it, even forever. But if whether this tale was used for burial of, you know, bones, who would remember that kind of a thing? You know, it's not, it's the kind of thing that maybe they'll remember, but after when 60 years pass, no one's going to remember that kind of thing anymore. So that's the way they in the end, try to connect these two things. In the end, they say, no, these aren't the same kind of things because people's memory works. We're going to see, I mean, this, I always found this a really interesting sugya. I forget, I think it's in Gittin, where they say, can you believe someone if they, what is it, that Dvarim Ba'alma Lo Dechir Ainshit, like if someone lied, I'm sorry, someone made a joke, okay? Someone made this statement, and they don't know, is he serious or is he not serious when he said it? So if he says, one opinion says, well, if he says, I don't even remember saying it, then we obviously know he's lying, okay? Because obviously he would remember saying it. And the other opinion says, no, if he was just saying it as a joke, there was this case where he said, I owe you money. And some people say he didn't really mean it seriously. So they say, well, how could you not remember? At least remember that you said it and just say, I didn't mean it. But he says, I don't remember it at all. So some people say, well, it must be he's lying. Other people say, no. When you make a joke, you don't remember jokes that you make. Like, you didn't say it in any serious way, so you don't remember it. When you say something serious, you remember it. But when you say, you're just joking around with someone, who can remember I made a joke yesterday? You know, that's not the kind of thing people... So the halakha is trying to get at what are things that people remember, what are things they don't remember, and, you know, there's obviously distinctions here about, you know, and the other thing is obviously distinctions about different people's memories, and everyone's memory works in a different way, and obviously we have a system here, and we have to come up with basic rules, even though they obviously don't necessarily apply in every situation. Did you want to add something?
About the burials, when they're talking about memory, are they talking about like some kind of a masoret that everyone knew that this was a tamei or a tahor?
Right, or are they talking about just someone remember that one time somebody buried someone there? I think it's more that was it used at all for burials and things like that. It's a good question. It's not 100% clear from here, or it's not clear to me. Are we just concerned that...
Because it's something that
through
all
something
the
happened
years.
On a one-off, or it was something that was used for burials, right? I don't know.
So it's something that would have been in the collective, maybe, you know, that's an area where we know people didn't bury because of what...
Right, or if they know, they could say, I know that in the last 60 years nobody buried there.
Yeah,
so you don't have to think further back, did it happen?
But how could someone know that no one was buried?
Right, yes. It's true. That's the question.
The memory that it didn't
right,
happen.
They didn't happen. That's also
that's
another question.
It
memory
like
of things
almost
not
like
happening.
A historic kind
right.
of thing. That
that's what all of Oh Hello is about. And, you know, I learned it. And
yeah.
So like the last Mishnah is all about how you have to inspect the house if a non-Jew lived there. Because the thought was so interesting. That non-Jews flush their fetuses down into the sewer.
Mm-hmm.
No, seriously, that's the last mission because
wow,
they don't know
impressive.
Whether or not, like, they have to.
Since you can't prove, you
can't
have to
prove.
Assume.
Right, so you have to assume
it's these might not have been. You see a mound that might not have even, and is